You're listening to Radio Orbit with Mike Hagan on KOPN 89.5 FM.
My guest is Dr. Eric Feigl-Ding. Eric is an epidemiologist, health economist, and nutrition scientist at the Harvard Chan School of Public Health. In addition, he's a senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists. He's an outspoken and valuable source of information regarding the 2019 nCoV coronavirus epidemic. I had the privilege of speaking with him exactly 2 weeks ago today. His opinion is highly regarded and sought after, so I'm thrilled to have the chance to get an update from him this afternoon. Dr. Eric Ding, hello, sir. Thanks again for taking the time out to talk with us here in the middle of the USA.
Yeah, happy to be here. It's a crazy epidemic, so glad to get the word out.
All right, maybe we could start off with a little bit of review. The last time we spoke, and we've got 2 weeks of sort of history behind us now, we started off by talking a little bit about incubation, transmission, and fatality rates. And I was wondering if we know anything more than we knew then today.
Yeah, in terms of a fatality, I think we've pinned it better to somewhere between 1 to 3%. And it seems like, you know, we know that children seem not to have severe cases, while the elderly have much more severe cases and mortality.
Yeah, the children issue was on my list here. Maybe you could expand on that a little bit since you brought it up.
Yeah, it was interesting. Like, there's almost no children under the age of 10 who have any severe disease. They do get infected, just like the rest of us. But in terms of being seriously ill, there's almost very, very few documented cases of it. And a recent study just showed that children seem to be 67% less likely than young adults of becoming severely ill. So in certain ways, that's good. But, you know, this is still a serious disease for the rest of us.
Okay. All right, so back to incubation, transmission, fatality. You said between 1% and 3%. I guess it depends on the circumstances, sort of.
Yeah. I think it also depends on where you are. You know, not every country has the same healthcare system. And, you know, like Korea right now has a mortality slightly less than 1%, but a lot of Korea has really good testing, and Korea's cases are still pretty young. The outbreak has not been going on for a long time. So I think, you know, in transmission also, in some places, it could be from 2 to 4 reproductive number, as in for every infected person, it will infect additional 2 to 4. But I think that number has probably come down with public health containment in terms of hygiene measures, you know, and social distancing measures. But at the same time, it's a serious runaway epidemic, you know, in many parts of the world, including Italy, a lot of parts of Europe, and it seems here in the U.S.
Yeah, there's been a lot of talk about Italy and some pretty extreme measures taken there. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what's happening there, and then I haven't heard much about other parts of Europe.
Yeah, well, Italy is obviously the worst in Europe, but it's growing in France, in Germany, in the UK. The numbers are basically going up everywhere. It's just Italy is facing the brunt of it because their epidemic in Lombardy province seems to be so harsh that they don't have enough doctors and nurses. They don't have enough hospitals or ICU beds. They're now even rationing who can even get an ICU respirator treatment based on your chance of likelihood of surviving. So in certain ways, it's very worrisome. And it's basically Italy is having a Wuhan 2.0. And are we having it here in Seattle area? I'm not sure, but the epidemic is definitely growing in the U.S. too.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the response here in the United States. There's been quite a bit of criticism out there in the world about the lack of testing and our inability to sort of get it moving. I think even now we're still only doing maybe 500 a day or so. I'm sure you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but what's happening with our response here in the U.S.?
Yeah, the testing has been such a mess. As I mentioned 2 weeks ago, we had some test kit problems, and just a ramp up of that in other states has been seriously, seriously constrained. The U.S., previously, just 2 weeks ago, was stuck at 500 tests cumulatively, and has not gone up much. At 2 weeks ago, but since then it's gone up a little bit, but we're still talking about only like a dozen or two dozen tests per state capacity, which, compared to that of South Korea, did 15,000, not 1,500, 15,000 tests per day in a small country of Korea.
Yes, yes.
And we're just not nearly matching that. We're finally ramping up a little more, but, I think we've had this epidemic since 2 weeks ago really, really cascade, and we know that we've basically had community transmission for quite a while, and community transmission cases are the worst because you almost can't trace where it came from. It's right. been floating in the community.
Well, I know there was a story that came out, perhaps it was yesterday, perhaps the day before, and I know you commented about it on Twitter, and I'd like to give out your Twitter handle if we could right now. If you'd like to follow Dr. Eric, you can do that on Twitter at Dr. Eric Ding, and that's DrEricDing. He has well over 100,000 followers right now, and it's well worth your time if you want to be up to date and up to the minute, pretty much informed on what's happening with coronavirus. He does a remarkable job on his Twitter feed and puts a number of updates up there every day. Mm-hmm. So anyway, okay. So yeah, I was going to ask you about a story where they essentially said they were going to stop testing in general in either the Seattle area or Washington. They said that the thing was now endemic and they were just going to quit.
Yeah. Well, that was for the Evergreen healthcare system, and they've since changed it, but at the time they were saying, well, upon advisement from the CDC, because it's so endemic, which it means basically it's been around for a long time, it's perpetual, and which is not true at all. This is such a new virus, and it's not anywhere close to endemic yet. To say we're going to stop testing, and that was extremely frustrating when I read that. And they since try to backtrack a little, but it's just, it's just so frustrating, the lack of testing. And even now at the nursing home where we just had three more deaths today, not all the patients and the healthcare workers at the nursing home in Seattle area has even been tested, even, weeks after the first outbreak have happened there.
Unbelievable.
So, It's terrible. In certain ways, there's also, Gates Foundation is stepping up. They're going to start distributing home test kits soon. University of Washington is ramping up its testing capacity to help the states and other areas. And they've also implemented the drive-through testing, which is really good idea because last thing you want is someone who has a broken ankle to go to the ER and get infected by someone who's coughing up a lung and infecting not just people in the waiting room, but also other doctors and nurses.
Yeah.
So having like a special, separate triaging area and a drive-through system, which it separates everyone from the rest of the people who are visiting ER, is a really great idea. And I think we need more of that nationwide.
Yeah, I think I read a story that some 10% of healthcare personnel that were working on patients in Italy were coming down with the virus themselves, doctors, nurses, et cetera.
Yeah, indeed. And in one hospital in Wuhan, almost 29% of patients in one hospital were actually the healthcare workers who were affected. But yeah, we can't have this happening because if you want to actually worsen the epidemic, it's to basically put healthcare workers out of commission. UC Davis when the California has its first case, UC Davis had to quarantine 128 doctors and nurses and other healthcare workers because of sloppy exposure to the first infected case. So then all of a sudden, all these 128 healthcare workers are now put out of commission for half a month. Hmm. We can't have that.
Right, right. Was there some sort of advisement about the length of quarantine? I've seen numbers like 14 days, and that didn't, it seemed to me that that wasn't long enough.
Yeah, 14 days is the standard. You know, we're working on a project trying to figure out, should it be longer? On average, the incubation time, which is what the quarantine is trying to lock down and, you know, and limit, is incubation is the time between your first infected and when you show symptoms.
Okay.
And so if someone was, say, shook hands with someone who is sick, we're trying to figure out, is this person who shook hands with the sick person also infected? Well, you would quarantine them for 14 days. Hopefully that if you did get sick, you would show signs or symptoms within 14 days. And if you didn't, you can be let go on the into the wild on the 15th day. The question is, you know, the incubation time is on average 5 to 7 days, but could there be an extreme tail of outliers who actually are having incubation longer than 14 days that the 14-day quarantine won't pick up? And so when you release them into the wild on the 15th day, they could actually still have been infected.
Mm.
This is something we're trying to figure out. There have been anecdotes of a few people in China with incubation longer than that time, but it is rare, but we're not sure how rare it is.
Okay.
But right now, for the most part, our containment is, you know,
okay.
Find who a sick person was exposed to, and then it's called contact tracing, and then quarantine those people. And this is why three members of Congress, Ted Cruz, Doug Collins, actually four, Matt Gaetz, and another Congressman Gozar, four members of Congress have been quarantined based on their exposure to someone at the CPAC conference.
Okay. Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's tricky. Like this virus knows no partisan bounds or levels of, you know, hierarchy.
Right. How mild can symptoms be? I'm concerned about very mild cases where people maybe don't even realize they have it, or just think they have a little cold or something, and then potentially could be spreading that around. Is that something to be concerned about?
Yeah. So mild cases is about 80%. Mild to moderate cases are 80% of all the infected, and then 20% of severe. And so some people say, well, if 80% are mild, that's okay. But, you know, a lot of these mild cases is not just sniffle. It's actually having a fever and having a somewhat of a pneumonia.
Hmm.
That is still considered mild to moderate. And so, you know, mild is a quote-unquote, you know, it's all relative.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, the other thing is, you know, mild, having 80% of the cases being mild is also a problem, because if it's too mild, these people still go to work.
Yeah, often
Sometimes they don't know whether, oh, it's just a sound, it's like a, you know, a flu, you know, sometimes I can still go to work with that sometimes. And these people, this 80%, suppose you have like 100 people like that, it can actually balloon the actual number of people who are infected even higher.
Right.
And this is why we need really generous sick leave and paid time off work policies, because especially a lot of low-income workers who are not on a salary basis, they are hourly workers, if they come forth and get tested and then they're test positive and get quarantined, they basically lose half a month's income.
Yeah.
And this is a serious problem, because then nobody wants to come forward and get tested. But if they don't want to come forward and test it, then they keep spreading it. It's a vicious cycle.
Man, oh man.
If you don't encourage people to come forward and get tested.
Yeah. Okay.
So this is why workplace policies are so important.
Okay. All right, let me ask you a question about reinfection. Do we know much about the ability of this thing to reinfect a person, like the flu or like chickenpox, something like that?
Yeah, I don't think it. So far, the rumors about reinfection, I think it's not necessarily reinfection, but that the body never really cleared it from the virus in the first place. So there's been anecdotes of someone who's tested negative, 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 and then tested positive later, or they improved all their symptoms. They tested negative twice, and then they go home, and then they test positive again and get sick again. That kind of thing has happened many times, but I think it's more of the fact that the test has a lot of false negatives. So the test does pick up, the positives are definitely most likely positives, but sometimes the virus could elude the test. You could actually get a lot of false negative readings in which someone is still being infected. And we know from China that their version of the test had been 50% accurate. And, you know, in certain ways, that's, you know, at least it's picking up the cases, and these are true cases. But for using the test to release someone and resolve them of the, and say, you're recovered, that's very tricky because the test has a lot of false negatives. And this is why CDC has to confirm a lot of additional tests. But this also slows down the process. So hopefully we'll get more accurate tests in the near future.
Okay. I'm here in Missouri, and we got the most recent news yesterday of, I think, the first case that was announced here in Missouri, at least, somewhere in St. Louis. And that was a situation where they had self-quarantined and then decided they were going to leave the self-quarantine to go to a high school dance or something.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I heard that case, too. I posted it as well. Really hard for people to self-quarantine. I understand that. You know, sometimes you have an emergency or some sort, but to leave the self-quarantine and then go to a public school dance event, I feel it's like very irresponsible.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like you're going to the store to just get a medicine and quickly come home, but you're risking a lot of exposure. This is why we have a quarantine for a reason.
Well, and I was also bringing that up just to make the point that we're right here in the middle of the country. And I mean, if it's you know, started on the coast, well, it certainly has made its way inland.
Yeah, there's a lot of cross border infection. There was a study that actually showed the Grand Princess ship off the coast of San Francisco that has 21 cases. That one actually is an import case from Washington cluster weeks ago.
Wow!
So the person who recently died. He was on the cruise. He had brought the virus onto the ship, and then obviously the ship sailed. He got off the ship at a stop, and now the rest of the ship has a lot infected. That actually came from Washington, even though the ship sailed from San Francisco.
Wow!
And we were able to deduce that based on looking at the mutation of the virus. So I'm pretty sure that, you know, we have cases across the country of people who've been traveling for the past 4 weeks, and there's a lot of community transmission. So I don't think anyone, unless you live in a log cabin in the woods, in a remote part of the country and not seeing anyone, I don't think anyone's entirely safe from this.
Wow. Would you say that, is anybody speculating, you know, people in your fields, are people speculating about perhaps the number of cases that might actually exist, not knowing because we're not doing the sufficient amount of testing?
Yeah, someone did some modeling, and they estimated by the end of February there was probably like several thousand, and now we're like approaching mid-March. I think there's probably over 10,000 cases in the U.S. that's been undetected, and that's a real concern. You know, basically anywhere you test, for example, at one conference in Boston, 60 people were exposed at a Marriott conference. So they took them to the hospital to test. One in four came in back positive, 15 out of 60.
Wow.
And in many other states, you know, the positive rates is like basically 1 in 5 people tested, 1 in 6 people, 1 in 4 people. It's really high. Now, granted, these are suspected cases, but I expect there's so much more. You know, these are just based on tests of like 2, 3, 4 dozen cases.
Yeah, very small numbers.
If you
yeah.
scale that up to all the number of people who have flu symptoms, this could be much, much worse.
Right, right. You mentioned mutations a minute ago. I know there are 2 strains of this that have been identified of the coronavirus that we're talking about. Could you talk a little bit about that, the fact that there are 2 strains, and how potentially probable is it for mutations to occur, and are those necessarily dangerous or sometimes maybe less so?
Yeah, well, mutations are a fact of life for viruses. And flu, by the way, has a different system for mutating than this coronavirus.
Huh.
And the flu mutates much faster than this coronavirus. So it's a long, complicated reason. So there has been suggestion of 2 different strains. There actually are many different tiny, tiny differences even within one strain. So they say that early on in China, there was one strain, but the export cases outside of China are mostly a milder strain. That is very speculative, I would say.
Okay.
You know, the problem is in China, in Wuhan, there was a higher mortality because anywhere, look, like for example, mortality is going to be very high in Iran and in Italy. Anytime the any virus overloads a healthcare system beyond its capacity, mortality is going to go up.
Mm.
You know, hence the
right.
you know rationing of ICU care to just those with highest chance of survival. So it's hard to say. Is it because that, you know, is it a more deadly or dangerous strain, or is it just that it had hit Wuhan early on when the mortality was high because it overloaded the healthcare system there.
Right, right.
We don't know for sure, but we're monitoring that. But for the most part, this virus is pretty bad, it seems, regardless of these kind of minor differences.
Okay.
And again, it's these minor differences that allow us to see that, you know, the San Francisco cruise ship strain is actually the same as the Washington State cases.
I see.
But
I see.
These mutations, yeah. like, don't worry about them from a public health standpoint right now.
Okay.
We don't think that there is like a deadly strain versus a non-deadly strain.
Okay. What do we know about China? I feel like I haven't heard much from China recently.
Well, China, the cases is improving. They basically cost your economy several percentage points in GDP growth because of it, and creating like supply chain bottlenecks for a whole range of different things. Now they're ramping up to getting people back to work, but the question is, now that people are getting back to work, is the epidemic could the epidemic still flare up?
Right,
because it was snuffed out for a while because they basically shut down the whole country and. You know, no one's going to work, no one's going to school. But now that people are going back to work and school, you know, is the worst over, or it could flare back up?
Yeah.
But, you know, right now there's, like a week ago, there's more cases outside of, more deaths outside of China than inside of China. And that's true, very much true today. For example, worldwide cases outside of China was 4,000 new cases yesterday. While in China, you're just talking about like sometimes less than 100. But the problem is, you know, is America able to do the full authoritarian type of lockdown that China does? I'm not sure it can.
Yeah,
NIH's Dr. Fauci says the U.S. cannot nearly match that kind of containment process. Which was horrendously imposing on human rights, it was very difficult for China to even do. And I don't know. This is today's stock market. I don't know if you saw.
Oh my gosh!
Totally tumbled and crashed. The worst stock market day since December 2018.
Yeah, it's been crazy, and combined with the last few days, I mean, I think the market's down some 3,000, maybe 3,500 points in just the last 3 or 4 days.
Yeah, and I'm gonna put it out there. I don't think we're done because I don't think. Some people say, well, now it's priced in. The market has adjusted, so it should bounce back up. You can buy a stock cheap. I'm not sure about that because, you know, I'm not a market analyst, but what I can tell you is that I don't think we've seen the worst yet in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Because have we had stories of ICU shortages yet? No, we haven't. When those stories start emerging in the U.S. like they have in Italy, the market's going to respond really, really badly.
Mm.
Have we had members of Congress test positive yet? Not yet. But if they do, it's going to be a canary in the coal mine of basically how bad it is in the actual U.S. if, you know, members of Congress start even testing positive. And those kind of things, like, and the mortality. Remember, the mortality lags behind the number of cases identified.
Right.
I think the not just cases going up, but mortality going up, that is going to scare the market a lot more in the coming weeks. So I don't think we're through the worst of it yet in terms of market reaction, let's just say.
Yeah. And as far as timeline, I mean, I guess where would you say? I mean, we're more toward the beginning than the end, I guess.
Well, we're definitely still at the beginning because all of our testing is still bottlenecked to some degree. There was an article that basically says the U.S. is only capable of testing like less than 2,000 cases, 2,000 samples a day. And, and the U.S. needs to probably do like 10x or 50x that amount to truly, you know,
get a handle on it.
Comparable to Korea's 15,000 tests per day.
Oh my gosh.
And so we're still also harvesting a lot of old cases from 2 weeks ago that should have been diagnosed earlier. The new cases that have not been fully diagnosed. I think if you look at it, in terms of U.S., the mortality in the U.S., just on the back of the napkin, currently, this is not the actual case fatality. This is just how many deaths there are per cases identified.
Mm-hmm.
We're like at like 4% or something like that. We know the true mortality is probably 1 to 2%.
Right.
So the fact that we're seeing 4 means we're picking up a lot of deaths, which means we're picking a lot of older cases, right?
Right.
A lot of the newer cases have not been identified. We have a lot of underdiagnosis. This is why, you know, we're missing a lot of cases in the denominators. This is why we think there's definitely over 10,000, we think. But we don't know until we have enough headlights to scan the darkness around us right now.
Yeah. Okay. All right. A couple quick ones here on the way out. What's your advice for individuals or families, if you have any? And then also, I'd like to ask what you'd like to see from the .gov, what you'd like to see the CDC, et cetera, National Institutes of Health, what you'd like to see them doing.
Yeah, in terms of family, I think we should prepare, but we shouldn't panic buy, because panic buying doesn't actually solve anything. I think we should prepare a family that, are we able to work from home? Are we able to, if the school department, school districts cancel, can we handle school cancellations and still work if needed? Mm. And if we can't work from home, what accommodations can we work out with our workplaces? These are the difficult conversations we need to have. And if someone in our family needs to be quarantined, which could happen, it's based on any random exposure, do we have a bedroom in a house that we can be used as a dedicated room for someone that needs to be quarantined and isolated? All these are very difficult. I don't have an answer for everything, but we do need to kind of keep these things in mind going forward.
Okay.
And as for government response, testing.
Yeah.
Obviously, but allow states and private tests to carry out more tests. And right now, it's ramping up. Focus on vaccine development, but I think there's many scientific groups that are racing against the clock trying to create a vaccine as soon as possible. And also the other thing is Americans want faith in their government. In certain ways, the CDC has to report how many tests are being done, not just at CDC, but across the country. Americans need to know, is it how many tests? Are we still at a bottleneck? We need answers for these. And CDC has recently eliminated the number of, eliminated the reporting for how many tests they're actually performing, which is very, very frustrating. It seems very, dystopian to kind of muzzle that kind of information.
Yes, I
CDC
agree.
Has to be transparent.
Yeah, I
and
agree.
CDC has to update its website over the weekend because, not working over the weekend, not giving the people new information over the weekend is very frustrating. People just want answers. They want to see that the government is providing as much information as possible. And transparency is absolutely critical for trust in this crisis.
Okay, absolutely agree with you. All right, last question. Has there been any progress that we know of with regard to a vaccination or immunization of some sort?
Yes. So the vaccines, different groups have said they've developed a candidate vaccine, but it has to go through phase 1 testing, then phase 2 testing, and then optimally at phase 3 testing. And, that is still quite a ways off.
Right.
One year's time for vaccine would be a world record. They're probably saying maybe a year and a half. But in certain ways, there's also antiviral drugs that they're testing that already exist on the market for HIV and hepatitis C. Those drugs, they're being tested right now. We might, if the results are very positive, we might get early results in late April. But there's no guarantee. Only under extremely successful circumstances will they release and end the studies early. But hopefully we'll get answers on antiviral drugs in a month or two.
Okay. All right. Well, that's the end of my list. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. A lot of people around here are really glad to hear some what they feel is valuable and authentic information coming from you. And we don't have a lot of it here in the middle of Missouri right now. So I really appreciate your time and everything that you're doing.
Best of luck. Hope to talk soon again.
Yep, we'll do it again. And thanks again, Dr. Ding. Take care of yourself.
Easy.
Bye-bye. All right, bye-bye. All right, Dr. Eric Feigl-Ding. He's an epidemiologist at the Harvard Chan School of Public Health, and he's also a senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists, or something to that effect. Anyway, valuable opinion, and I'm glad I had a chance to talk with Dr. Eric again this afternoon. On the web, you can find out information and really stay up to date with what Dr. Eric Ding is doing on Twitter, @ Dr. Eric Ding, DrEricDing. That's Dr. Eric Ding on Twitter. Certainly updated regularly there, and I appreciate all the information that he is sharing with us, and I'm glad to be in touch with Dr. Eric, and we'll get him back if need be, okay? All right, it's Mike, and you're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia 89.5 FM. We're about 5 minutes after